Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and I am very excited today to talk about one of my favorite subjects in a podcast that has set itself up as defense of capital markets, financial markets. I want to talk about what has become, I think, unfortunately and unfairly, one of the most demonized aspects in financial markets, and that is the world of private equity. And to join us today is going to be the author of a brand new book on private equity. His name is Sachin Kajuria. I recently read his new book that has tackled this subject of what private equity is, how private market investing has become so popular and expansive. The name of his new book, by the way, is 2 and 20, How the Masters of Private Equity Always Win. And initially, when I first saw the book, I thought that title was suggesting something that was going to be derogatory about private equity, like, oh, here we are again, the big guys always winning and other people are getting screwed, and let's go reveal how evil the whole concept of private equity, financial markets, etc. may be. Well, that's not at all what Sachin did with this book. And so we're going to bring on Mr. Kajuria to explain the themes of the book himself, what he has learned. He was a longtime partner at the Apollo Group, which is one of the major private market investors, for those who don't know, out of the destruction of Drexel Burnham. And there's a name from the past. When Milken went down in the late 80s, Leon Black, one of the key people at Drexel, along with a couple other principals, started Apollo in the early 90s. They've now grown into a global behemoth in equity and debt and real estate investing. Our guest today was a partner at the Apollo Group for some time, had a 20-year career in private market investing, and now has a lot to say about the subject. So I'm going to bring him on. We'll have a conversation. I'll come back with some concluding thoughts on private equity. And with that said, welcome to another episode of Capitol Record. And welcome as our first-time guest, brand new author, Sachin Kajuria. Welcome to Capitol Record.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am excited to have this conversation with you. I have recently read your brand new book. We love having authors of new books about different aspects of financial markets on the podcast, and sometimes those episodes have not only helped people run out and buy the book, but they've been some of our most kind of conversational podcasts that we've had generate a lot of buzz. This topic is one of those. Sachin, you chose to write about the private equity industry, having worked in it for the bulk of your career. But what made you actually want to write this book? What was it that kind of inspired you to give a broader audience a better understanding of how private equity works?
So primarily, to me, it's about the democratization of finance. A lot of people don't know much about private markets, or in particular private equity, or they know a little bit, but they may have either misconceptions or they want to learn more about it. But when we look beyond Wall Street on Main Street, a lot of folks actually don't think about it at all. They don't think about the number of companies whose goods and services they may buy or supply to that could be run by private equity. They don't necessarily think about the fact that some of their pensions, if they have a pension program, could be partly invested in private markets like private equity. And so I think there's a lack of general knowledge and understanding amongst the broader populace, which, for example, you don't find with public markets. Most people know about the alphabet soup of acronyms that cover big tech companies, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Alphabet, Tesla, but they may know big tech, but they don't know big finance. And where private equity is today at about $12 trillion across private markets, and I think that's figure is steadily going towards $20 trillion in the next decade. these are huge numbers. And people need to know more about this. Doesn't mean they need to be scared about it. There's no alarmist factor here. But they should know about it, not only because they're probably a consumer of it, or they may even work in a company that's partly owned or has capital lent to it by private equity, but also because their retirement may partly depend on private equity already, or may do so in the future as more retail investors are given access to these funds. So I really wanted to spread the knowledge beyond Wall Street, beyond the kind of probably typical guests that great podcasts like yours have, or a lot of the folks that you meet, to other people that really need to know. And that takes a number of forms. I think, first of all, it has to be, you know, pretty direct, I think almost blunt in writing style. And so you notice the book is not really written as an academic volume, like a major defense of private equity or a major attack of private equity. It's kind of written for most people, hopefully, to find accessible. And so we tell the story of private equity the way I've experienced it, which is fortunately how the best firms do it, the ones who do it really well. And we talk about how they're able to consistently beat the market. How come some firms, with all the compensation formulae and so on, are able to consistently beat the market and other firms are not? And I think it comes down to a winning psychology, a certain number of key traits. And we tell those traits out through stories, deal stories. And then we put a big glossary at the back to make sure that everyone can understand. So that's really what was behind the book and why we've chosen the way it's written. And I hope people find it accessible and it helps them really understand this industry better.
Now, I'm not sure what you're allowed to say and not say. I assume you have a pretty fair freedom here, but feel free to push back if there's anything you can't announce. I know you were in the private equity industry as a partner at a large firm. And if I am allowed to, I'll say the name of the firm. Is that all right? You worked at Apollo for, what, 15 years?
So I was there for about 7-8 years through the great financial crisis until I started my family office. And before that, I worked at another firm that were managing major LPs, doing pretty much the same thing, but on a smaller scale. And so in total, my time in private equity has been about 20 years so far.
And listeners to this podcast know that I run a large private wealth RIA. Both Apollo and Blackstone have been large equity positions of our equity portfolio for a long time. And particularly Blackstone is one that we have a lot of their various products, private equity, credit, real estate. Interestingly, Apollo is now making a huge move into private wealth distribution. And we've just recently had some meetings there. But, you know, these are household names for people in our world, in Wall Street. But you said something a moment ago, and you say it repeatedly in the book, and I think it's an incredibly important point, but I'd like you to maybe clarify it for listeners. I think that people talk about private equity monolithically, as if there's beta in the asset class. And you point out it's done, when it's done well, it has a certain characteristic. There are now so many GPs out there. Private equity at this point, the deals that we see on our desk are not just whatever the new deal from KKR, Carlyle, or Blackstone is anymore. Do you believe that this democratization, this advent of many, many smaller cap companies, lesser bureaucracies, is a good thing in the industry, a bad thing? Or do you think that dispersion of results can be a little bit of both? It can be both good and bad. What's your take on the just wide expansion of new players in the industry?
That's a fantastic question. So let me start with this. Let me be clear. Private markets, the most famous of which is private equity, is a field where America leads, full stop. It innovates, it creates, it galvanizes, it has the biggest firms, the biggest funds. And more important than size, it has, I think, pretty much the most successful folks who work in the industry. And I've been extremely lucky to learn from some of those. And even now running my family office, I'm invested with a number of those firms. And you mentioned one of them, Blackstone, but there's others like Carlyle, Silver Lake, and others. And so, you know, we should recognize that this is a success story for America. And, you know, that's a really good place to start. So having established that, so innovation in this industry takes a number of forms. I think number one, if you think of private equity as a leverage buyout and that's it, using high yield bonds, taking a company over, maybe taking it apart, maybe selling it piece by piece, or maybe not, maybe keeping it together, then selling it in a number of years, 5, 7, 10 years. Then it's like sort of looking at private equity as if it was a Motorola cell phone from the 1990s. Whereas in reality today, private markets are like the latest iPhone. They can do so much more. And private markets today are really about how private equity firms, some people call them alternative asset management firms. In my book, I actually try to coin a new phrase. I call them mainstream active asset managers because I think they're no longer alternative, they're mainstream. These firms have demonstrated evolution as an edge. So when there are good buyouts to do, they try to do those. When there are carve-outs, build-ups, take private transactions, hybrid deals that some of your listeners are very familiar with, PIPEs, tactical opportunity type things, you know, hybrids between debt and equity, they do those. They've grown phenomenally since the financial crisis in credit. As banks have retrenched, as there's been white space that's been left or created, they've gone into those spaces and actually created new niches as well, going into pensions, going into annuities, going into insurance, going into lots of areas where they're generating not just alpha through buyout and related buyout techniques, but also generating yield, because this is a world where yield is very important for all those pension funds and retirement systems. And so when we look at the modern mainstream private equity firm, we're looking at firms that can do private equity as you used to know it. That's the kind of Motorola cell phone. But it has so many more apps. It has the credit app. It has commodities. It has infrastructure. It has real estate. It has technology. It has social impact investing. It has, who'd have thought this, life sciences, drug development, which has boosted a lot since COVID and the pandemic. It has so much more that I'm not even mentioning. And that means that the menu of options for investors, historically just institutional investors, but increasingly retail investors, that menu is growing. It's not just one page long. It's several pages long. And these firms are always raising for one strategy or another. And you don't have to say yes to any of them, or let alone all of them. And so what I think this is about is, rather than just looking at how much do I put in stocks and how much do I put in bonds or T-bills and a bit in real estate, it's about some of the pie chart of what you have to invest. Do you want to tie it up on an illiquid basis or less liquid basis in some kind of closed-end fund or perpetual capital vehicle or some structure that can probably generate you a return, if you pick the right guys and the right fund, above what the public markets are giving you? And that's really what you're paying for. You're paying for that active management. This is not something that an ETF can do. This is not something that machine learning can do. This is highly active management driven by people. And that's why we keep saying in the book, this is a people business. And it's those people you're incentivizing and compensating to get the job done. And that's why people are going to have this choice if they don't have it already. Do I put some of my assets in private markets? And all these examples of innovation, to be honest with you, these are incredibly healthy things because it means that your alternative to public markets is just growing. And just like public companies make mistakes, private equity firms make mistakes, of course. Who's perfect? They'll learn from those mistakes. And I think we'll see this industry set to continue to become an even more important part of the investment landscape.
So one of the interesting things about what you just said is it has a side of a coin that was very compelling to me when we became large alternative investors. Of the roughly $4 billion that my firm runs, about $1 billion of it is in alternative type products. That includes hedge funds as well, but private markets is a large part of what we do. And when you talk a moment ago about their expansion into credit, real estate, infrastructure, Blackstone in particular, but all these firms make a really compelling case for this intellectual capital, idea sharing, and the ability for them to utilize and leverage the resources of one part of the building for the other, that they have a kind of collective brain trust that leads to good idea generation, execution, research, decision-making, all those things. So I see everything you said as a positive. There can be setbacks, negatives, bad decisions, unforeseen circumstances, macroeconomic, what have you. But by and large, I see this as a benefit. There is another argument that I vehemently disagree with, but nevertheless, I want to get your take on, that this expansion is something we need to fear. That it was one thing when you had little KKR with $50 billion, you know, 20 years ago, but now every one of them has a global real estate presence. They all are the first bidders on major real assets. They're involved not only in equity and various mom and pop lemonade stands, but they're the key debt players in so many deals. And that we need to be worried about the concentration of power. We need to be worried about the concentration of wealth. Now, I would say, all things being equal, I prefer the risk-taking be in the hands of private actors, as this structure really is conducive to, that we don't have to worry about a systemic bank risk like we did, as you point out in the book, in the meltdown of the financial crisis. And I would also argue that so much of what we're talking about, the expansion into credit and real estate and balance sheet activities from these players, a lot of it is because Dodd-Frank disintermediated the investment banks and put a lot of the capacity for this investing in the hands of people like Blackstone and Apollo and so forth. So I guess I'm wondering if you think there's legitimacy in both sides. Do you favor more the positive argument versus the negative? But what is your take about those who generally would view this expansion and see it as a concern as opposed to an opportunity?
So I think that people are absolutely right to question and to notice the expansion and ask what it means. I don't think that people are not like even allowed to ask that question, whether they're regulators or they're investors or the media or anyone really. You know, whenever we have an industry that has got this big, it's entirely healthy to have checks and balances, and that includes scrutiny. I think that's just totally right in our democratic system and in our market-based system. But I throw out a few facts that should hopefully frame that, shall we say, analysis and investigation, and probably more accurately, we should say monitoring, right? So number one, in the financial crisis, a number of banks, insurance companies, other entities went bust. We all know about that. And since then, we've seen a number of hedge funds go bust. Return capital, they're not working out, and so on. How many private equity firms have actually just blown up since the financial crisis or even in the financial crisis? Very few. In fact, I'd be hard-pressed to name a major one that I've dealt with. And so, of course, it's a people-run business. People may be doing better or worse. Maybe that firm is not performing as it ought to and maybe doesn't continue past a fund or two or three. But in terms of a blow-up, like you're talking about systemic risk that has collateral damage, that has other impacts across the economy, we haven't really seen that. And so I think it's fair.
And by the way, if you don't mind, I'll add, and in the title of your book, 2 in 20, it almost has a overlap in certain areas with the hedge fund space as well, such as that compensation structure. even in those hedge funds that you speak to having blown up, it wasn't systemic risk. Some people lost a lot of money. Some people who lent them money lost a lot of money, but it wasn't systemic. It was isolated to the risk takers in that hedge fund. And like you point out here with private equity, people have lost money on deals, people have lost money in funds, but nothing that approaches a systemic level.
Correct. And it's a good point you make about hedge funds too, that perhaps more hedge funds than individual private equity firms have kind of shut down and returned capital. It's also a function of their business plan and business model and so on. But there hasn't been a systemic impact. Neither has there been, for example, the kind of bubble and crash that you've seen, for example, with crypto. You haven't seen that either, where everyone's piled into this asset class and it's all suddenly blown up and then it's come back and all of that sort of stuff. So it doesn't have the same volatility. So I think that's important as a baseline. I think once you build on that, you need to look at whether that risk is developing. And that's fair, because a lot of credit now is being handled by private equity firms. And it's totally fair to want to check, to want to investigate, to want to see. But unless we see systemic warning signs, for example, that a number of franchises are all going wrong for the certain reasons, and consequently they're bankrupting businesses down the line and there's a chain effect. If we're not seeing that, we certainly shouldn't be either assuming it's going to happen or expecting it to happen or advocating that it might happen until we know how it could happen. And remember, most of these deals are ring fenced. So for example, if you're a private equity fund and you lend to me and you lend to one of your colleagues and we're both portfolio companies and we both blow up, well, hopefully you haven't put all of your eggs in one basket or two, and actually you can still withstand some losses. It's not quite the same as venture capital where you have a number of ones and a number of zeros, but you're trying to make money on every deal. And even if some don't, the fund itself should still survive, even if it doesn't, do as well as you thought. So I think we just need to sort of level set that discussion. I think, the other thing that's very fair is to ask whether the terms of this activity are somehow disadvantaging anybody, right? So if banks are retrenching, are the terms of private equity deals, when they're lending and so on, just manifestly unfair, or is there something really bad about them, And I think there you do have to look at the micro, not the macro. And you've got to, check and make sure that nothing that shouldn't be happening is not happening and people are not, being taken advantage. But I personally haven't seen it. And, what I have seen is a lot of situations, for example, in the pandemic, where there was no government bailout coming and a lot of businesses could have gone to the wall, or at least they would have struggled much worse than they did if they didn't have access to some form of private capital. And I think that private markets have stepped in a lot of cases where there has been no other solution. And it's been fair. It's fair to recognize that. Of course, they're doing so because they want to make a profit from it. But that's the whole point. They're investing pension fund money. That pension fund money has certain obligations. Maybe they've got to meet a 7, 8% hurdle rate. Maybe it's more, maybe it's less. And they can't get that just by the public markets. I mean, look at what happens this year in the public markets. If you had all your money in the public markets this year, you'd be worried about whether you could pay those pension entitlements, right? So you'd want to be diversified. So I think we need to sort of, respect where the questions are coming from, if I may, but also just level set that discussion and make sure that it doesn't turn into something that's unnecessarily alarmist, and also give credit to the fact that we haven't seen that systemic risk so far, and we should be really specific about if we do see it, whether really it is systemic, as you say, or whether it's isolated to individual deals or firms.
Well, your point about the diversification of some of these strategies and the ring fencing of deals, and of course this happens to be an example with your old firm, but one of the really just compelling, page-turning, couldn't-put-down type business books I've read this year was a book that walked through in detail the failed Apollo investment in the Caesar's Palace. And yet, what was fascinating is after what ended up being a really significant amount of equity capital loss, in that deal, that fund that held that deal made money and actually had, I think, a 15 or 16 IRR despite a multi-billion dollar capital, you know, extermination. And so, you know, some high profile deals garner a lot of attention. And yet when diversified and properly stewarded in a broader context, it tends to be that many stakeholders come out quite fine. But again, I'm struck by, and it's really hard for me to be playing devil's advocate here because I truly do not believe in the side of what I'm sort of representing, but it's helpful to get your context on it. Some would say that the idea that these guys still end up doing well, even with these failures, even with some of the particular cases that don't do well, that speaks to a kind of inequity of the system. I had someone who I respect a great deal on the podcast recently who's become a pretty leading critic of what he refers to as financialization of the markets. He's a thoughtful guy, but I disagree with him. I debated him on this subject here on the podcast. But his view was that the private equity players get the benefit of diversification. So when a deal goes bad, they have other deals that work. But the laborers of these companies that get straddled with additional debt and end up not making it from time to time, that those workers don't have the benefit of diversification. I have my retort to the argument, but is that something you think is solvable in a free market economy? Do you think that, what would your general take be to that kind of concern?
So, look, I think one of the biggest areas where private equity and private markets in general have improved in the last decade in particular is they are much more aware, and I think self-aware, about the community impact of every deal. And you see it. You know, in fact, you only need to look at their websites if you want any proof of how much resource they're putting into looking at the social implications of transactions, ESG, but much more than that. You know, a lot of them have foundations for charitable investing. They put money into community development. A lot of them now in different forms, but a lot of them share profits more than through the C-suite. When a deal goes well, they're actually spreading those profits among a lot of the workers. And there are a lot of stories on that kind of activity, which I think is, you know, really positive. And so I think that they're thinking a lot more about these things. And, you know, I think it's important I don't speak about specific deals. So if I say in general that I think that what you're asking is there an inequity when a private equity fund can still do well, even though some individual investments and therefore people who are involved in those investments, whether they're workers or communities, can end up suffering. Look, obviously nobody wants that to happen. You could go back a stage in the life cycle of investing and say there are plenty of venture funds that have lots of strike ups and blowouts of companies at an early stage, and then the next day they discover the next Facebook or Google, right? And so we do have that dynamic in our system of survival of firms as well as firms that don't survive. But I think that as the scale in the industry has increased, I think the dialogue certainly feels a lot more human. I'm not saying it wasn't human before by any means, but I think you can feel it a lot more now, and you can see the investment in the social side of deals a lot more. And I don't think, and I think they're thinking about these issues, you know, much broader than, you know, just is my own investor making money on this deal or not? And partly that's a function that society has moved, right? Society itself has, and that includes the investors in private equity funds, I think are asking about, okay, that's the numbers of the deal. Talk a bit about the social impact of the deal. That wasn't always the case decades ago, right? It was often just the numbers. And so I think we've all moved in that direction of, you know, thinking a bit more holistically. And if you step back, it makes sense because at its most basic level, what private equity does is invest money into an operating business or lend to it, seeks to improve it, and then will exit that business, hopefully for a profit, in the medium to long term, 5, 7, 10 years, right? And often you know, each deal is an important part of the investment professional's life, not just their career, especially if they take 10 years to fully execute an exit. And so what they're doing is piercing the veil between just the financial analysis on the one side and the operating analysis on the other. And what I'm saying is that operating analysis now includes factors in the equation, such as the social impact, such as what happens if the deal doesn't go well. How do we, minimize damage if things don't go right? And I think, you know, the only way that private markets can do this effectively is by themselves. They have to be the ones taking the decisions. They have to be the ones living with the results. I don't think you can, it's not something I think you can regulate. I think it's something that, you know, the better firms are naturally moving in that direction. And if you look, you know, look at their websites today, they're full of words like responsibility, trust, community. Things have moved on, and I think it's important we recognize that and we support it.
Do you have an opinion about the tax deductibility of interest expense in the debt portion of deals?
So I think that I'm going to make it a slightly broader question and possibly even more controversial, which is
I was going to go to carried interest next.
Yeah, so I thought I could head. That's where you're heading. So yeah. I could tell. So I thought let's just jump there. Look, I think the fundamental aspect of private equity investors, private markets investors, I think in general, is they eat what they cook. And I summarize it in the book by saying you have to think like a principal, not like an advisor. You are an engaged owner of the business. You have some of your own money in the deal. Sure, there's much more money from the ultimate investors like pension funds, retirement systems, sovereign wealth funds, and so on. But you act as a principal. There is absolutely no question in my mind that folks who are working in this industry act as principals. They think as principals. They are living these deals as if they are personal deals. Absolutely. And so they have their own capital at risk, even at a junior level, actually, a relatively junior level, they'll have capital at risk. They certainly have their careers at risk. And they're doing this job for a number of reasons, but when it comes to the compensation aspect, they're not just doing it for the management fees. They're doing it to actually make money when their investors make money, right? It's a really simple equation. And this business attracts people who want to do that, who want to back themselves, back their friends, their colleagues, their teams. And so when you look at it through those eyes, it absolutely makes sense that this is principal activity, not the activity of a consultant or a good advisor. And I think that really answers your question. And I think it's really true. I mean, I've seen it, you know, every day, 20 years as an investor, 5 years before that as a banker serving the industry, working in investment banking, supporting private equity firms. And so this is active investing. It's done by people. They have capital at risk and they're absolutely taking decisions as principals, along with the management teams, right? You don't look at the management teams of these companies and say, well, you're working on this business as the CEO. Actually, it's not carried interest. It's not capital gain for you. It's something else. Well, it is capital gain. It's capital gain for everybody working on the deal. And so hopefully that tells you where my sympathies lie. And I think it's a major part of the incentive and a big part of the reason why this model works well.
If the carried interest were taken away by either a Democrat in the White House or a Republican in the White House, whoever is in Congress at the time, it does seem it's been threatened through both parties in power, and it hasn't happened. There's been slight tweaks in Trump's 2017 tax bill, but do you think it would fundamentally damage innovation, entrepreneurialism, risk-taking in capital markets, or do you think it's marginal? At the end of the day, is that tax rate a substantial part of incentives and risk-taking in private equity?
So I think that it's important to recognize that there have been big changes in the spread between income and capital gains taxes, right? Not just in the US, but also abroad in Europe, for example, in the UK, and I'm sure in other places. There has been change responding to some of those points about, you know, broader shoulders and sharing more of the tax burden and difficult circumstances. So I think we should acknowledge that. I'm not sure it's something that you can effectively change every few years, right? Especially when the deals are not 2-3 year deals. The deals are multi-year deals. So it's not something you want to change within the term of a transaction and remember who you're investing on behalf of. So I think it's already happened, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily the right time to look at it yet again at the moment. I think that also we need to think about the customers, the clients. Are the investors in private equity and private markets saying, oh, this is all wrong, this totally has to change, this doesn't work? I'm not sure they are. And so when you have, you know, your investors happy, I think pretty much, that you're doing a good job, and if you're delivering, and if there already has been substantial change, you know, I would probably say this is not the area that makes much sense to focus on yet again.
Yeah, you bring up a lot in the book, and you've mentioned it a few times here in our talk. It's such a significant part of the investor base of private equity, particularly very large and established private equity institutions, are pension funds. And oftentimes those are public employee pensions. And it is somewhat ironic to me that there is a certain movement of demonization of Wall Street and a certain movement of class warfare. There is, I believe, a lot of times a certain virtue signaling around some of the ESG convo, and yet then everything I hear is that CalPERS is forcing a huge increase in their private equity allocations. And so it does seem that there's a sort of political narrative saying the carried interest is the biggest atrocity in history, with most people not really understanding how it works or why or the math that is involved with it. And yet, to your point, it seems like the investors, including ones who have a pretty broad set of stakeholders they have to serve, like a teacher's retirement fund, for example, they seem to be doubling down.
So there's a couple of things I'd say. I think number one, I do not believe that like private equity is perfect, in the same way that I don't believe that it's terrible. And we need to get away from this antagonistic narrative of saying everything in our society is either terrific or terrible, right? You know, we see that when we talk about the media, politics, you know, so many different topics, right? And is it constructive to look at everything through that lens? I don't think so. And so I think we need to, you know, call out when things don't go well, and investors should obviously vote with their dollars if they're not happy with the performance. But for the firms that are doing well, the kind of places you've been talking about, and the ones that I sort of focus on in the book, you know, what I call the masters of private equity, the folks who do it really, really well, who are succeeding above the market performance time after time across strategies, I think we sort of realize that they're driven by a winning psychology. And that's driven by the sort of tenets we talked about, like you eat what you cook, the attraction to complexity, using complexity as a source of value. They're not looking for the shortcut, like so many of us are today. There's a hack for this, there's an app for that. They're going the long way because they want to try and really dig through all the detail, like financial investigators. And other traits too, you know, evolution we talked about. And in the book, we talk about other topics, like a key one, I think, is the paramount importance of temperament. You know, these firms can hold steady when they need to pivot. You know, so their psychology is not, they're not freaking out. They're not suddenly firing everybody and moving on just because there's a mistake. It's not the kind of public company reaction you sometimes see to a crisis. They're not sort of, you know, they'll sort of calm down. Well, we've seen this before. Can we fix this? Okay, what do we need to do? Do we need to change personnel? Maybe we don't. You know, maybe we actually need to lean in more. Maybe we just change the horizon of the deal. Maybe we alter our thesis. And so I think when you look at all of this and you sort of get away from the mindset of, you know, am I either wholesale defending this or wholesale attacking it? Yeah, you just have a much more intelligent, constructive, and I just think helpful conversation about where private equity can work well, where it can allocate capital effectively, and where for investors it can answer what I think is the key question, which is, Am I getting adequately compensated for the risks that these guys are taking on my behalf?
And well, I think that your approach there is so incredibly wise and important. And I would point out that nuance doesn't tend to do very well in a period of polarization and tribalization. But that nuance of not needing to look at everything is so binary, and either villainizing or lionizing, it would have come in quite handy out of the financial crisis as well. It probably would be useful when we think about banks and credit at large. In other words, the way you brought up media, government, there are other institutions as well. And it seems to me that we can offer thoughtful critique, change, suggestion without this incessant villainization that often is quite anti-intellectual, but also can be destructive. You know, people can be critical of public health care. I don't think we want to get rid of hospitals. People can be critical of private equity. I don't think we want to get rid of ongoing innovation in financial markets that help feed businesses, credit, and equity in time of need. There, I think your point is helpful and yet probably more universal than just merely as it pertains to private equity.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I try to make clear in the book is how I've seen responsibility permeate from the top right through to the bottom. You know, the guys who lead these firms, let me be very clear. They are the first people to put their hands up when there's a mistake. And they're probably the first people in the investment committee to talk about that mistake, happily or unhappily. You know, this is wrong. I don't believe this. What's going on? And you see in the chapters when we sort of forensically analyze different deals and we go through the questioning, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted. I think in one scene, I describe it like gladiators fighting for their lives in the Colosseum when they're in front of the investment committee. You know, they really try to sort of turn the screws and try to understand all of the basic factors that drive deals when they're approving deals, even when deals are going well, but especially when deals are going badly. And so I think you see that responsibility. And going back to it, the reason you see that responsibility is not just because of the 2-in-20 formula. It's not just 2-in-20 solves everything. It's because, you know, lots of firms that have 2-in-20 don't outperform the market. So why is that? It's because of the winning mindset and the sort of traits we talk about in the book that I think the best firms all have in common. And I'll leave you with one point, because you mentioned it before. We didn't touch on it, but it's hugely important. It's in a chapter in the book that I call The Library. And The Library is about, it's my way of characterizing the phenomenal data and data science these firms have across the economy, because they are collecting, processing, considering data, they're discussing things with CEOs, they're taking temperature, they're, you know, doing litmus tests of what's going on, they're taking surveys of sentiment, they're able to populate their information set with so much more data than small firms are. They're kind of running away from the rest of the pack, because they're doing what I call, they sort of have a moat around their business, right? And so that's why they can see where the puck is going, you know, not where it's going now, but where it's headed, right? And so that all those things, they can sort of have a little bit, I wouldn't say, it's not quite like a sixth sense, of course, but they have an ability and a lens to look through a lot of information that other investors don't have, because they have, you know, so many of these strategies and verticals. And that, I think, is part of that edge that you talked about. And let's not forget, that is another example of innovation.
Yeah. That's such a great point. Look, I really can't commend the book enough. I appreciate your willingness to come talk to us about it, but also your willingness to tackle the subject, to do so in the manner that you did. We'll keep mentioning it here at Capital Record. And I appreciate you spending this time. Best of luck with your ongoing conversations about the book and this cause. Thanks very much for joining us on Capital Record.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much, and it's been great questioning, and I hope some stage to come back at some point.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I assure you that it was one of the harder ones for me to hold back on how granular I wanted to go, and all the different perspectives that a couple financial nerds like me and Sachin could have gone into. I think he wrote his book, and I think he conducted this interview today with a really good regard for the broad audience, you know, to make sure that he didn't get lost in the weeds, that he was trying to explain a message, to use his phrase at the beginning of the interview, about the democratization of finance. There are things going on in private markets that other people besides large, massive institutional investors deserve to participate in, benefit from. And this demonization of capital markets is going to hurt that cause, not help it. But without me getting into the sort of theology of my view of economics, the anthropology that I talk about week after week here for those of you who listen to Capital Record all the time, without me going into that subject with Sachin, I assure you that a lot of what he was saying is a testimony to this dynamic of economics being the study of human action. The case he's making for private equity is a case for human action. It does not rely only on this hyper low cost of capital. Now, low cost of capital can help. It can also hurt. It can distort transparency, distort visibility and sensibility of certain deals. But these very well-heeled, established firms that have this mentality, to use the word he used a few times, that have this mentality of vigorous principal investing, of paying a lot of attention to detail, of being really, obsessive risk managers, these guys were making incredible money in deals when the cost of capital was five times what it is now. And I think that the reason that we look to this space with the excitement we do is not merely as an asset class. It is an elaboration of human activity, both of portfolio companies, underlying entrepreneurs, people in need of growth capital, people who get into a bad and distressed situation, the business is failing. That's part of human action too. Failure happens. And yet sometimes there are folks who can realign strategy, infuse new capital, have a change of perspective, a change of personnel. See, this to me represents a kind of landscape of what we refer to when we talk about the human action of an economy. And the world of private equity has been a place in which this has played out, generated great returns, created new wealth, done it sustainably. And that's what he talks about over and over again. It's not trying to make a quick buck. It's not one quick deal. There's incredible analysis. There's incredible projection. There's strategy. I believe that the essence of this podcast from the day we started has been an ideological defense of free enterprise and capital markets. And if we do not defend the great innovations in American financial markets, we don't deserve to keep our free enterprise system. With that said, I hope you got a lot out of the podcast. I hope you feel you learned a few new things. Do check out Sachin's book, 2 in 20, How the Masters of Private Equity Always Win. And thank you for listening to Capital Record. Rate us, review us, subscribe, and we'll see you next week.